national and local boards, a union representative, and instead he's been replaced by somebody reciting statistics in defense of network television. What do you make of that?
I believe that's what they call convergence in the media.
A result of experimentation by the networks in a new program form. That experimentation goes on today, and we have greater diversity, more different types of programming, more different suppliers of programming today in network television because the networks are taking more of the risk, funding more of the development process. And to sum up, there's more choice, more diversity, more different types of programming on the television networks today as a result of the financial interest and syndication rules. The networks are investing more money in new and experimental forms because of the freedom from these rules. The viewer is being served by these rules, and that is what counts in the long run. Thank you.
Robert, we should point out to our listeners that we will have a union representative about all of this after all of the people have been heard from Columbia Law School in New York. We're scheduled to talk with James Joyce, who's a vice president of NABIT and CWA.
Indeed. And this section of the program, of course, is on the entertainment part of the media. And this is Jenny Toomey, the executive director of the Future of Music.
That's how I got into this stuff. I was a musician and still am a musician. I also ran an independent record label, put out over 75 releases with my partner, Kristen Thompson, who's also on the board of the Future of Music Coalition, and who actually did a lot of the research in this study that has been cited a couple times today, which is a study of the impact of radio consolidation on musicians and citizens. It's called Radio Deregulation: Has It Served Citizens and Musicians? And because I was told I was not allowed to read this entire thing to you out loud in my 5 minutes, I would just let you guys know you can go to futureofmusic.org and you can read the executive summary, which is only 6 pages, which summarizes a lot of the key findings, and then you can go deeper if you find it interesting. Future of Music is an organization that was set up to try to build structures that would allow for a working musician's middle class. And we define that by being able to make a mortgage payment, have health insurance, and access to an audience. So what do we work on? We work on contract negotiation for artists so they can have a fairer portion of their creativity or of the value of their creativity. We work on figuring out ways for more musicians to have access to health insurance. And this radio study was an attempt to look at why more musicians weren't able to get on the public airwaves. And to look at it as a cautionary tale so that we could see what the kind of impact of concentration would have on future media forms like the Internet. So what did we find out? A couple things. We found that radical deregulation of the radio industry allowed by the Telecommunications Act of 1996 has not benefited the public or musicians, and instead it's led to less competition, fewer viewpoints, less diversity in programming, and deregulation has therefore damaged radio as a public resource. The research that we have in this big document makes an overwhelming case that market consolidation intended by the Act, this was actually the function of the Act was to lead to consolidation, does not serve the diverse needs of the American music community as well as American citizens. And substantial ethnic, regional, and economic populations are not provided the service to which they are entitled. And we also had a survey that basically proved that the public is not satisfied and that there are possible economic inefficiencies of industry consolidation that are not being passed on to the public in the form of improved local service. Now, there's some specific sort of findings that I want to detail. First of all, I wanted to talk about the four key findings are that 10 parent companies dominate the radio spectrum. And that may not seem like a few, but the concentration is very severe. Two parent companies in particular, Clear Channel and Viacom, control 42% of listeners and 45% of industry revenues. And this is something that's really happened in the last 6 years. A lot of people have talked about Clear Channel, and that's maybe the most significant number, where you've got a company going from 40 stations to 1,240 in a period of around 7 years, which is incredible consolidation. Now, how does this impact musicians? It impacts musicians because oligopolies control almost every geographic market. And every music format is also controlled by an oligopoly, which leads to fewer and fewer gatekeepers. So fewer and fewer accesses to radio, which is, I think, something that Elizabeth was talking about. The few radio stations that she was able to get to as an independent artist are now consolidated and have oftentimes nationally programmed playlists, which means that, you know, we say there's about 15 gatekeeper companies that you have to get in through in order to be on the airwaves. And this study doesn't really do a lot of discussion about independent radio promotion as payola, although there we cite a lot of really good research. Eric Bollert from Salon.com and Chuck Phillips from LA Times have done some work talking about the fact that the overwhelming majority of music that's on the radio is actually controlled by the five major labels. We found between 80 and 100% of songs on radio by format are major label releases, which means there's a real difficulty for people who don't work within the major label music system getting access to an audience. I only have 1 minute left, so I would like to talk about three little things. First of all, there's a meme within this environment that says that consolidation will lead to more diversity, and the argument goes that if you're an owner and you own four stations, you'll program them all differently, because if you do that, then you'll draw in a broader audience. Well, that isn't a meme that has come from nowhere. That came from a very specific study in 1954 by Peter Stirner, who was talking not about competition in a marketplace, like two different companies fighting in a marketplace, but about the BBC. And they said if you're the BBC and you're a monopoly and you own everything, then you have no incentive to program two stations the same way. You want to actually build, you've got the entire market, now you want to make it bigger. So I think if we can come away from this meeting with a couple new ways to think about radio. When someone says to you there's absolutely no incentive for a company to program two of their stations the same way, we should think about Starbucks. We should think about if there's any incentive, any market incentive for Starbucks to have two Starbucks on the same block. Well, sometimes, you know, they might be cannibalizing sales from somewhere else, but maybe the fact that there are two Starbucks on one block means that they actually draw more people to that place and increase sales. And the fact that we see this kind of market incentive happening in other places, we've actually documented a number of examples, thousands of examples of corporations having the same format in the same marketplace. So that's the first thing. The second thing I wanted to say is that format variety is not a fair measure of format diversity. One of the ways the FCC has measured diversity on their waves is by the number of formats. And one of the things this study has been good at doing is looking at the fact that there's incredible radio overlap playlists. So two supposedly distinct formats will have as much as 76% of the same songs between playlists. So I think I sympathize with Chairman Powell. It's very difficult to measure diversity, but we need to be very careful looking at what we're actually doing. Some of the studies that he has asked for, the last 12, are very, very good, and they get us almost in the room where we need to look a little bit deeper, but maybe some of these problems are in the closet, so we have to go a little bit deeper into what we're looking at. The final thing I would want to say is that this was a very expensive study to do, and hopefully you guys will get a chance to read it, but we do need more of this research. We do need more measuring, and I would encourage all of you guys to read it, to look at it, to begin to discuss these issues, and to encourage your government, your FCC, to help us see this data, because all of this data that we use to crunch these numbers is proprietary. We had to buy it, and it'd be much easier to look at how diversity was being affected if there's a public collection of this data that was made available to people so we could actually see how this consolidation was affecting our access to the airwaves.
Jenny Toomey is the executive director of the Future of Music Coalition, which has done a study on the withering of radio variety in content and format at radio stations under deregulation. That report has been challenged by the National Association of Broadcasters representing owners. This is Pacifica Radio, pacifica.org.
Station owners in local markets, revive creative programming.
And this is a question session for the panelists you just heard. The moderator is P.J. Bednarski, who is an editor of the trade journal Broadcasting and Cable.
You have to compare what's today and what it was 20 years ago. I don't remember radio being any more diverse in terms of its, there was sort of a period in the early 70s maybe, but over the last 20 years, I don't see big changes in radio. I mean, has there been during this consolidation period, the last couple of decades?
Yes.
Elizabeth?
Yeah.
I have not seen.
It's been enormous, actually. The easiest place to look at that and see that and see the change really is in college radio, which is now really has been shut down basically because record companies realized with the onset of actually the band REM, who rose to fame and fortune via college radio. That's when it really started happening. From what I saw, it was about the mid '80s to late '80s, and. Well, college at that time, college radio wasn't so sewn up, and you had the opportunity where you didn't have playlists on college radio unless it was like an enormous college. And now, as you travel through the country, most colleges, I would say, are on playlists, and those playlists are filled to the brim with larger independent record labels that are usually owned by major record labels. So I have personally seen
your gripe is then with the record companies. The non-commercial stations, college radio stations, aren't really part of this proceeding.
So it seems that your gripe is with the
record producers, not with the media.
I think you're restating her point wrong.
Okay,
but I think there's three things. First of all, one of the main goals this consolidation, right, was it's very expensive to run all these radio stations, and what you need to do is let us get more of them so we can have economies of scale. We can fire some program directors, we can consolidate some programming, we can make it more efficient so we can actually compete with all the other media. So one of the basic functions of this idea was reducing the expenses, and one of the major expenses is programming. And there has been an incredible streamlining of playlists. And that's something that's documented in this report. So, first of all, there are fewer gatekeepers, as I said before, and that's what, one of the main reasons why it's more difficult to get on the airwaves. The second thing is about demographics and getting attractive demographics. If you've got three major corporations, each with eight stations and a major marketplace, all competing for the same most attractive demographic, then and we've got these formats overlapping as much as 76% of playlists, you know, you can see why we're coming up with the same songs over and over and over again. And
but the record companies are owned by corporations. I mean, that's the reality. You know, it's not just I have a gripe with the record companies because they're Warner Brothers, AOL. I mean, they're all owned by God, which is, you know, three people own the entire world at this point. And I think it's not, you can't just have a gripe with the record companies because it all goes back to the same corporations that are the gatekeepers and other people like that.
And the final point is that there were finite numbers of licenses that you could get. Once we raised the caps, there were a number of corporations that went out to actually get from four stations to eight in all the major markets. And oftentimes, these were the mom-and-pop stations that disappeared. So when I started touring as a rocker 12 years ago, there was a very strong college station in almost every market. But that is not the case nowadays, and these smaller college stations are not just carrier current. Many of these are tastemaker stations, are important stations, and to see them go means it has incredible ripple effects throughout the entire music community.
But again, what the FCC is doing have no effect on that, on college radio stations, what their playlists are.
Sure, if those licenses get sold. But
we're talking about these college stations are non-commercial stations. They don't get bought and sold. They don't get absorbed into big conglomerates.
Sure they do. But there are a finite number of licenses out there. So when you're actually going to buy certain numbers of stations.
Some few are, but I would say the majority are not. They're set aside. They're in reserve for non-commercial radio stations. Really, it's not. Somebody will back me up on the commissioner? Or, pardon?
Exactly. But
yeah, but it's very minor. I guess there's been a few examples of that, Jeff. But
it might be minor to you, but it's
okay.
Not minor to
pardon?
Us.
Okay.
Two women's voices are Elizabeth Ziff of the pop group Betty and Jenny Toomey of the Future of Music Coalition.
No, we'll come back to it.
An interesting thing that needs to be noted about college radio is that there is a controversy here right in New York over the allocation of antenna space. WFUV here in New York is trying to get a higher antenna, and that may shut out another innovative college radio station, WFMU, in New Jersey.
And when we're talking about non-commercial broadcasting, basically, Robert, there's also the question of the previous board of Pacifica and its plans to sell WBAI and KPFA because they happen to be located on the commercial band. When they were contemplating changing the bylaws to make that possible and to make themselves possibly wealthy in the process, these two stations, Pacifica stations, were worth something like $300 million. So the moderator is incorrect that there aren't some commercial interests at work.
And this is Pacifica Radio. My name is Robert Knight in New York. That's Larry Binsky in San Francisco and Berkeley, California. And you're listening to Pacifica, available on the web at www.pacifica.org.
This is David Poltrack of CBS TV.
The biggest successes in network television in the last several years have been Survivor, Millionaire, and our reality programs. The fact is, reality programs didn't get made when we had the financial interest and syndication rules because all the money, all the programming was funneled through the major studios in a system that did not allow programming that didn't have a syndication market to get through. The networks, in search of experimental programming for the summer, discovered reality television, and guess what? They discovered not only does the American public like it, they like it more than a lot of the programming they have been watching, and it's risen to the top. Reality programming is not on the air because it's cheap television. Reality programming does not repeat. The economics of Survivor are not more favorable than the economics of a regular season series. Survivor is a very expensive program to produce. It only runs once. It does not repeat. It has no syndication market. It has no syndication value. Reality programming is a different economic model. It is not cheaper. It is not on because it's cheaper. It's on because it's getting into the top 10, because young people are embracing it, because Madison Avenue is embracing it, and because it's part of our common popular culture. This is what it's all about here, Dan. What does the public want to see? Do they get a great diversity of choice? Do they get the chance to pick the programs they want to see? They do. There are more television programs on television now. There's more television programming being developed. And these are the shows that are winning the battle with the consumers. That is the reality. I know it puts actors and actresses out of work. I know it hurts the craft unions, but that's the reality. This is what America is voting to watch.
Well, David, I think I have a little rebuttal to that, and it says the idea that content exists because it's what people want is false, a myth. The real issue is that content exists because it is what advertisers want. How else can you explain why shows like Felicity run ads at about twice the cost of ads for the Steve Harvey Show, even though both shows get a similar number of viewers?
The fact that programming, what you're talking about basically is that Madison Avenue, advertiser-supported television favors programs that appeal to younger people. That is true. There's no question about it. We have the average person now turns on, when they turn on their television set, they have 102 different choices. The programming that is going to sell the most advertising time is the programming that appeals to young people. That's the commerce of the business.
The speaker is Dave Poltrack of CBS, and he said that Survivor is on the defense that people want, but that show has not been submitted to the same tactics within Survivor as to whether the viewing public can vote what show should go off the air.
Our Monday night schedule has a 75% African-American audience. That programming is profitable. It is successful. It is supported very strongly by Madison Avenue. John Mandel is here. He can testify to the fact that Madison Avenue supports African-American minority programming. We are putting it on where it makes sense. It's there. It is getting seen. It is not as unilateral a picture as you paint it to be. Yes, the advertisers, people are going to go where the money is. Advertising is going to be geared to a certain demographic. We're going to try to serve that demographic. But in the collection of all of the media assets of a company like Viacom, we are supporting all different demographic areas. We are, as it was specified before, BET is part of our company as well. The fact is, there's room for everyone, and everyone is getting served in this environment. And with 102 choices, you don't have to select from the narrow base of the broadcast networks.
There's room for everyone, but there isn't money for everyone. I mean, I think people are watching what's shoved down their throat. I mean, I really do. I don't think that this is a reality. I mean, I really think that you need to know that people are watching what they're told to watch. And you think that people have a choice, but they don't have a choice because there's 102 channels on, you know?
Well, sure.
Because there's 102 channels. When you turn on your television set, you can watch 102 different channels of television. There are actually about 250 different programming sources. What other part? When you go in the supermarket, how many choices of soft drinks do you have? How many choices of anything do you have? I mean, this is one of the areas of greatest choice in our society right now. Is the area of television programming.
When you log on to AOL, what are the banners that are on AOL? What company? What television company is represented there? I mean, you don't have the advertising that's advertising for 102 channels. You have advertising from big corporations that own other companies that are advertising and using that advertising. And that's what people are seeing every day on the street, on television, on the Internet.
I don't understand the relevance to what people have, the selection of product that people have when they turn on their television.
Well, the point, excuse me, you can't speak that. The point is, and I'll try to anticipate, the point is that there's, and Clark, you sort of make this case too, there's a lot of outlets here, but the fact is, cops had the chart up here, there's five companies. Five points of view.
You know, you made the point before, and again, this is a misnomer. This is a basic issue. You made the point earlier. You quoted Richard Bellotti's statistics. You said that five companies represent, I think five, you named about five companies, AOL and the four broadcast network owners, and you said they control 85% of the viewers' choices. You used the figure 85%. That isn't, we don't control 45%, 85%. As I said, we're 4 out of 102 when you turn on your television set. We control 4%. We have 85% share of audience because that's what people want to watch. We put on the best television programming. People don't have to watch it. No one's demanding that they watch this programming.
David, I'm
85%
about...
share is, we have an 85% share collectively with all of our outlets. But that's a little high. It's about more like 70% of viewing. But that's the viewing selection. We're only four
channels.
They're
inundated by your advertising. Inundated. It is everywhere. It's omnipresent. You can't avoid it.
Yes, you can. You can turn off your set. Clark, do you have
it? If you walk down the street and there's advertising, you go on the subway, there's advertising. You go on the internet, there's advertising. There is advertising everywhere.
I don't think the FCC is here to decide whether we want to eliminate advertising.
We're not going to debate advertising supported programming. That's life. What you should do is maybe, I think you've got a problem with the non-commercial stations. What are they doing advertising? That might be a problem that you should address. And what are they doing with playlists? Why aren't college radio stations, you know, I don't look at this.
But we're talking about television now, we're not talking about radio.
Mark, do you have any thoughts?
The only point I made, and I didn't get to it in my presentation, is everybody needs to consider what is the future of free over-the-air television in this whole debate. And I don't know of any business model that has one revenue stream that can compete effectively with another business model that has two revenue streams. And I'm not going to jump into the argument that's going on either side of me, but I would like the audience to consider that very important question. Are we all going to end up watching the Super Bowl on pay television? Because that's exactly what's going to happen if these current trends continue.
Is it possible that, this is my own question, is it possible that there's too many outlets, too much, I wouldn't say competition, but too many outlets, and that it fragments the audience, that they can't, and this is, I think, maybe true in news, so many outlets that none of them really can support real good news, real investigative reporting, enterprise reporting, or, you know, the best quality programming, and that, you know, NBC can't do football anymore, and the networks have to go for a cheaper reality program.
Well, let me address about the quality of the program. right now, if you talk to the critics and you talk to the people in television and you name off the shows that are on television today, and you name off shows like West Wing and Everybody Loves Raymond and Will and Grace and Friends and Alias and 24, the quality of the programming that is on television today is comparable, if not superior, to that of any particular point going back in time. There's a tremendous amount of great television on. If people disagree that Sopranos and 24 and West Wing and CSI and if you think that's bad programming, if you don't think that's good quality programming, then I can't do anything for you. But most Americans think it's great programming. The critics think it's great programming. The people in the industry think it's great programming.
Tom,
we are not in a cultural wasteland here with bad television programming. We have a lot of great television programming. We have 102 channels, so we have a lot more programming, and some of it isn't going to appeal to you.
That's the reality. Let's see what the programmer has to say.
I'm confused about one thing you keep saying. You keep saying 102, but then you keep saying there's only four. I honestly can't do the math with you.
There are 102 channels. The average television home, when they turn on the television, now has 102 channels to choose from.
I understand that. But what I'm saying is that you keep saying, though, that the four networks are the most popular, even though you keep it's 4%, it's 3%.
They're 4% of the choices. They're 4 out of 102. That's 4%.
Oh, 4% of the choice is not getting 4% of the audience.
No, they're getting a substantial share of the audience because they have the programming that people want to watch. But they will not continue to get that programming because you have a lot of other choices. If somebody on the other 102 channels comes up with something better, then the audience goes. The networks have lost some of their audience in this competitive scenario.
But you said that the audience was down. You're saying the audience is good, and you're saying the audience is down. I don't understand. I don't understand. Is it down or is it up?
In the year 1984, when you turn on your television set, you had about five choices. Now you have 102 choices. When people had five choices, 90% of the viewing went to the network. Now people have 102 choices, and the network share is 47%. Now, you may call that erosion. You may call that losing audiences. I think that's extraordinary resiliency, and that testifies to the popularity and strength of the network. They've gone from being 3 out of 5 choices, or 60% of the choices, to being 4 out of 100 choices, or 4% of the choices, and they've only lost, and their share of market has only gone from 90 to 47. That's extraordinary resiliency, and that's a testimony to the fact that people like network programming.
You can respond to that, but I'd like you to address this question. Is TV better now after 20 years of deregulation, or is it worse? I mean, let's get into the qualitative a little bit. I tend to agree with David on it. I think television today is better than it was 20 years ago. I like West Wing better, and I like Starsky and Hutch.
Well,
better show.
I've been doing this over 20 years. I don't think in the 20 years that I've been doing television that the quality of television has gotten better. I think that there have always been excellent shows. I could give you a list from 1980 of the same number of shows that were considered, that the critics loved, that the audience loved, the one you just gave. The idea isn't so much that there is more quality now than there ever has been before. The question is that are the number of people who are generating, is the less number of people who are generating the programming leading us in a specific direction? And I would say yes, because I would say that any network that says, and Dick Wolf is a very dear friend of mine, we need 3 hours of Law and Order a week, or that we need 2 CSIs a week, are people who are limited in their vision. It's easy to say, let's do another CSI. Let's do CSI Paris. Let's do CSI on the moon. You could do all those, and they'd probably be as good as CSI is. But is that diversity in programming? Is that increased the quality of television? Personally, I don't think so.
Okay. David, you can't answer
everything.
Harry, can I say something?
The point of CSI and Law and Order is a very important one. I would argue that anyone that says that a program such as CSI or Law and Order that is that good should be confined to being broadcast 1 hour a week in an environment where there are 102 channels to choose from doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
why can't you have?
We're not talking about 102 channels at this point. We're talking about CBS or NBC.
Okay. Well,
and what we're talking about is, as you've already very clearly stated, the excellent reality programs that are muscling off so much of the. And if you tell me that Survivor is a quality television program, I can't even begin to understand that kind of thinking. But my point, more to the point, is that there isn't a lot of room on CBS or NBC, so the hour shows that are on have to be quality because there isn't any room anymore for any of the others.
The Survivor, if you don't believe the Survivor is a quality program, I mean, that is a very, very subjective thing.
Well,
I would say
it's a subjective thing. Picasso, some people like Picasso, some people don't. But what I'm telling you is, are the critics falling all over Survivor? Your critics that you talk about? No.
They are. I believe.
Well, Tom, there seems to be room
that
for
most
it.
People in the industry
I'm not
think
saying,
that
no,
Mark.
Listen, I will say this. I love the fact that television, the thing I love about television more than anything, is that there is room for Oz and room for Touched by an Angel. To me, that speaks to the extraordinary gift that television is to the American public, to the world public.
I think that's David's point. There's 102 channels. There's room for all kinds of stuff.
No, but we're not talking about 102 channels. We keep coming back to the four. We keep talking about the majors. And if you're talking about the major, there's very little real estate on CBS.
Gentlemen. In the last year of the financial interest rule, there were 38 different production entities in business with CBS and primetime. 38 different production entities listed as in business with CBS and primetime in the last year of the financial interest rule. Currently, there are 41 different production entities in business with CBS and primetime.
And how many of those programs does CBS own?
We have financial interest in those programs. As I stated in my...
41 programs.
Not in all of them, no.
Which ones don't you have? I'm just curious, because...
I believe there's six programs we have no financial interest.
Well, come on,
wait.
That's what we're talking about.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to wrap it up.
You can't leave it there, because I think I didn't make one very important point.
This is a very important point for the FCC commissioner. Our financial interest is not complete financial interest. It's participation. And as I stated in my, it's very important to understand, a significant amount of the time, when we take financial interest in a program, it is because we cannot find the partner to take on the risk for this programming. In this point in time, our financial interest in a significant number, not all the time, but in a significant number of cases, our financial interest has been a last resort to get a program mix and to team up with creative people. We have financial interest in our shows. It is vital to our survival and our continued development to be able to have that financial interest. But that financial interest that we have in those shows, it does not in most cases, in partnership with other creative people. There is many people drawing equity in entertainment product on our air today as there were before the...
And CBS has never said to any production company ever, we will not put this on unless you give us a piece of it. I'm sorry?
Okay. Nothing. Come on. This is getting very interesting. I think we need a new panel. Thank you.
That is the Media Ownership Conference at Columbia University Law School, and that particular segment you've been listening to is the Entertainment Forum, in which, unsurprisingly, in a room that was dominated by presenters who are artists or creators, that much of the fire was concentrated upon the representative of the networks, one Dave Poltrack. of CBS, who seem to be asserting that the profitability of the networks with shows like Survivor is implies that the shows are of quality rather than attributing the success of the broadcast networks to the familiarity of their long tenure or to their easy access as broadcasts, which is easier to get to than a wire through the cable, or the deep corporate pockets that the traditional broadcast networks may have. This network is Pacifica. My name is Robert Knight in New York, and Larry Binsky is in Berkeley.
And you know, Robert Knight, that the panel desperately needed a cultural studies representative who could have said some things about lowest common denominator entertainment programming and the supposed public trust that comes with licensing of commercial broadcasting. It needed a Neil Postman or a Neil Gabler or a Pat Osterhide or somebody like that who could have gotten up in the face of the person who says, well, it makes money, and therefore, and people are watching it, and therefore it's fine. Elizabeth Ziff of Betty began to say, you know, like, you guys have all the advantages. You cross-promote each other. You own all the other media that people log on to. You have synergy, so-called, in your television and radio programming and in your movie theaters, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, you have an enormous advantage over anybody else. What has this got to do with freedom of expression?
There's another issue here, that the assumption is that the process of television is to bring programs to the viewers, although it is equally viable to analyze it as a process of bringing consumers to the advertisers of those shows.
Well, it was a lively discussion, and it's continuing in Columbia University, where neither Robert nor I is. We are bringing this to you through the electronic magic, which we finally seem to have conquered the gremlins in that we had this morning. Robert's in the studios of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. I'm in the studios of Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. The forum is taking place at the Kernikan Center for Law, Media, and the Arts. And the point behind it, which you may have certainly been forgiven for not seeing during the last panel, was to discuss media ownership patterns and the possibility that the Federal Communications Commission may allow even fewer multi-corporations to own more and more media, and to what effect that would be done. The next panel that is about to be seated contains representatives of community voices, one a representative of AFTRA. I mentioned before that Dan Ingram, the legendary DJ going back to WABC in New York, who's now at WCBS.
Dandy Dan Ingram.
Dan Ingram was supposed to be on the last panel as an AFTRA representative. We do have Tom Carpenter from AFTRA scheduled to be on the next panel, the Community Voices panel, as well as William O'Shaughnessy, who is president and CEO of WVOX and WRTN. I'm not familiar with those stations. Are you, Robert? Where are they? What are they doing?
I have not listened to them personally.
I don't know where they are. We'll find out soon enough. Florence Rice is from the Harlem Consumer Education Committee, and Dorothy Sigpen of Third World Newsreel. Hopefully those people, especially the last two, are in the room as the last panel is taking place and can address some of the many unaddressed issues, one of which was,
Larry,
what about the diversity of voices in the entertainment industry? Where's all that in this whatever makes money is great philosophy?
Larry, another interesting point was made by Thomas Fontana of the Oz series and Homicide on HBO when he spoke about indentured servitude among creators, where the mutual ownership of different networks by one corporation, cable networks, means that an artist can be sold over to another network for reruns or residuals at a discount rate. That is the basis of a lawsuit that some of the people from X-Files and others have made in regard to Fox and FX, and that's a creator's issue of media diversity.
We are Pacifica Radio, and if you support this kind of broadcast and you support the fact that we are the only network that took the trouble and went to the expense and difficulty of broadcasting this since it began this morning at 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Western, we would hope that you would log on to www.pacifica.org. You'll see a flashing icon there which will enable you to go to a secure website and make a donation of the money that keeps this non-commercial, advertising-free, subsidy-free network alive on the air to do the kind of thing that we're doing today, trying to get back to national programming after a long period of time when our network itself was in jeopardy. We now are slowly rebuilding it. It's a great pleasure to be a part of a national broadcast once again, but we need your support to make it happen. www.pacifica.org. is the address. We need several thousand dollars, very little money by the mass media standards that are being talked about here today, but still the kind of money that we need to keep us going. So it's www.pacifica.org. And if you're not familiar with our organization, you'll find out a lot about it right there.
Larry, I'd like to just point out in response to your question that WVOX is based in New Rochelle, a suburb of New York City, and WRTN is also a New York regional station.
Okay, we'll find out more about those when this panel gets seated at Columbia University Law School. This is the next to final panel. The final one is going to be addressed to business concern. Then there's going to be a woman summing up from the executive director of the Turnican Center. And after that, Robert Knight and I'll be back. We'll be taking listener phone-ins again nationwide and our toll-free number. We'll sum up some of the things that were said today and give you a perspective on where all this is going, whether the FCC will, in fact, need to deregulate or not when they take up this issue in a few months' time. There's still time for public comments, Robert, about this, and people who are interested can go to various websites. I believe Jeff Chester mentioned in that interview with you that his website is one place that people can find out a way to express themselves. That's democraticmedia.org, www.democraticmedia.org.
I need all my panelists up here also.
And further information on the comment process is available even on our own Pacifica.org website.
Great. Such a complicated website, I'm not familiar with everything. There, it changes all the time. But we do know that the one thing that never changes is we always need money desperately, even the little bit of money that it costs us relatively to do something like this. And people who call up and make a secure donation, and it is secure, on the web to us, it is also tax deductible. If you've got $100 or $500 or even $50 or $25, you think this broadcast has been worth it. We've gotten a lot of response here, Robert. I can tell you the phones have been ringing a lot. People who appreciate
that. One of the things that Pacifica Radio is a rapid deployment force of popular communication. The point has been made that none of the corporate networks are covering with the fullness that Pacifica is today. We have brought this together virtually overnight, and that's because our listeners want a difference in their broadcast, and they support us for it. And we encourage you to do so by visiting the Pacifica.org website.
Go now to the moderator, P.J. Bednarski, who is editor of the weekly trade journal Broadcasting and Cable.
We're going to hear some community voices now, starting again from the right, Thomas Carpenter. He's with the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. Next to him is Katina Perrin, Executive Director of Children's Press Line. Bill O'Shaughnessy, President of Whitney Radio and Editorial Director of WVOX and WRTN in Westchester. Florence Rice, the Harlem Consumer Education Council. And Dorothy Sigmund, is that correct? Third World Newsreel. Let's start with Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you. I'm Tom Carpenter. I'm Director of News and Broadcast for AFTRA, which is an organization that represents 80,000 performers and also journalists, including journalists who work at local television and radio stations around the country in markets of sizes from big to small. On a panel to discuss community, it would be impossible to talk about community without talking about the value of localism, which is one of the key policy aims of the existing regulations. And, of course, it's integrally related to the other policy aims of diversity and competition. Local communities obviously need access to diverse editorial perspectives from competing voices in the marketplace of ideas. I think it's safe to say that localism has suffered as a result of deregulation that's already occurred. And the prime example is, as many people have indicated already today in other panels, is in radio. Since 1996, the deregulation of the radio ownership has been a disaster for radio. And just to put You know, I know earlier people were talking that we should not be giving emotional examples, and I think the reason that people were saying that anecdotal examples are emotional is because, frankly, most of them are appalling. And the most appalling of all in radio is the concept of voice tracking. I wanted to talk a little bit about that to illustrate the principle of how local communities are not well served by consolidation. Voice tracking, if you don't know what it is the system by which live radio has been replaced with pre-recorded entire radio shows. Essentially what happens is a radio announcer goes into a studio and they record the liners, the tags, and the announcements. That's later edited in between the music and songs, and that's broadcast later in a market far from where it was recorded, as though it were a live and local radio show. And in reality, it is neither. The announcers who do these voice track shifts, they have cheat sheets with local community names and places. They are encouraged to pretend, they are required to pretend, in fact, that they are living and working in the communities where they're broadcasting, but they're not. And the most recent thing that we've discovered is that, to kind of take it one step further, radio announcers are now being asked to record calls, dedication calls that come into the station. So essentially, if you're in Washington, D.C., and you call up the oldie station, you want them to play Stevie Wonder for your wife's anniversary, that call is recorded, and it is broadcast as though it were a local call in Detroit or some other market. And that's the kind of thing that's happening in radio. And the reason it's happening is because radio players have become so large that it is not economically feasible for them to serve local communities. And I hate to say it, but it's already starting to happen in television. Voice tracking, of course, is only possible when stations are owned by large media conglomerates. Sinclair, which is an owner of television stations, has recently announced that it will no longer be broadcasting weather reports, local weather reports in Dayton, Ohio, on the weekends. Instead, they're going to have their weathercasters in their corporate office in Baltimore, Maryland, doing weather reports. Now, you might say, well, it's just weather, and what's the big deal? Anybody can do weather. But the point is that weather is a story that, aside from the travel forecast, is purely local. Weather is a story that requires the community to trust the people who are providing them with that information. And like all news reporting, our members who work at broadcast stations around the country work hard to cultivate their credibility and to develop that relationship with the community in which they work. Unfortunately, it's been our experience that corporate owners of media, when it's not economically feasible for them to serve the local communities, have increasingly looked for ways to sacrifice the community's needs for a higher stock price and higher profit margins. So, in conclusion, you know, I've got plenty of other examples which I'd be more than happy to share, but I think that the regulations that exist now are critical to protecting the interests of local communities. Thank you.
Tom Carpenter, who is National Director of Broadcast Division of AFTRA, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists Union. This is Katrina Perrin of Children's Press Line.
Commissioners and the panel organizers for understanding the youth perspective as part of the Community Voices panel. As the program director for Children's Press Line, a youth advocacy journalism program that brings youth voices to the mainstream media, I have a great deal of concern that cross-ownership and deregulation will silence the voices of youth even more than they currently are. Children make up 26% of the population, yet according to a study by Children Now, only 10% of TV news stories feature children. Almost half of these feature kids as criminals or victims. Only 3% talk about kids in economic or political sense. Overall, only 13% of children's coverage discuss public policy issues. As adults, we have the responsibility to act in the best interest of children, not because they can't advocate for themselves, but because we don't let them. We don't invite them to sit at the table with us and discuss issues that are important both to them and to us. Our worst error comes when we don't consider them when we make decisions that directly affect them. In the FCC's 68-page Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, the word youth doesn't appear at all. children appears only once, and that is when referring to a 1960s law regarding the responsibility of broadcasters to provide children's programming, a purpose the FCC has since deemed itself inappropriate to provide. Every moment of my day is spent valuing the voices, experiences, and lives of young people, of people under the age of 18. The fact that the FCC hasn't thoroughly considered how deregulating the media will affect the development, welfare, and livelihood of young people is disheartening. We ask Chairman Powell and the commissioners to delay their decisions until a working group has thoroughly examined how deregulating the media has deregulating the public airways and relaxing newspaper cross-ownership rules will affect children. In our current Amsterdam News article available on NewsAms, our young journalist interviewed two young independent media makers who realized that the struggle, that their struggle to bring their work to the mainstream audience will only get harder with deregulations. To save costs, networks will increase the practice of keeping the creative process in-house, eliminating the interactive, inclusive process of creative programming. As Wendy 19 and Christian 18 of Manhattan Neighborhood Network's Youth Channel told our reporters, why should a handful of companies be able to decide what does or doesn't get on the radio, TV, or newspapers? The whole process has really got to be a collaboration between the community and whole organizations of people. Listen to 11-year-old Natasha Kirchuk, who's sitting right in the front row over there. Interesting TV and radio gives kids something to chew on. Adults want to limit the amount of violence on TV because it may give kids the wrong idea. Fine. But also understand that we get good ideas from things we like. And if what we hear or see in the media doesn't challenge us to think outside of the box, we're not going to get those good ideas. Everyone thinks that kids just watch and watch and watch TV. Well, maybe we do talk about it a lot, but it's something we all do. In the media, we can see different ways that kids can be and adults can be, and it helps us learn. Kids like seeing kids on TV because they have a special place in society. We see the kids on TV, and they are accessible to us. We can see kids being important, and for once, we see people actually listening to them. They make being a kid important because that's their job. In real life, we don't have jobs or place in society. It's because we can't vote, but that's another topic. More of Natasha's words can be read in next week's Amsterdam News. Natasha is 11 years old. She opposes FCC deregulation because she knows that as a young person interested in the world around her, she will have a difficult time getting balanced, unbiased information from newspapers, radio broadcasts, and TV news. She fears that corporate propaganda and companies' own political agendas will take priority over journalists' responsibility to inform the public. As it is now, children are only interviewed in one out of every five stories focused on them. That means the other four stories let adults speak for kids, some as experts, academics or professionals, some as parents. But few let children speak to their own experiences for which they are unarguably the expert of. Every single one of the interviews we do at Children's Press Line, we let young people speak in full about their realities. Why? Because we know that kids are the expert of their own experiences, not parents, not researchers, not academics. It's easier, a.k.a. cheaper, for the news media to talk to adults than to kids, but that doesn't make it okay. And with the money-making focus of deregulation, it won't be getting any better. The stories the press is already overlooking include kids as landmine victims in Pakistan, kids suffering from bipolar disorder, and kids struggling with their own stance on affirmative action. These are the stories that need to be addressed in the mainstream media so adults will have a deeper, more complex understanding of the issues that young people face. These problems don't come from bad kids, but from adult-led societies that don't value young people. I'd like to leave the commissioners by restating our request to delay the decision on media ownership until the working group has thoroughly examined how deregulation will affect children. Again, I thank the commissioners for their time and the organizers for inviting 26% of the population to have their perspective here today.
Katina Perrin of Children's Press Line. Here on Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the forum from Columbia University on media ownership.
Harry, I want to thank you for that wonderful introduction.
This is William O'Shaughnessy, who owns two suburban radio stations in Westchester County, New York.
10 seconds in the intimacy of this room to just acknowledge our great debt to you, our gratitude, because your brain and your intelligence and your mighty pen have kept the government the hell out of our processes for all these years. So you know how much I admire you. He's a great man, and I'm glad to share the podium with him. I hope you won't hold it against me if I work both sides of the street on this question, honorable commissioners. I am the permittee of a radio station which is endowed with less power than any other in the New York area, a throbbing, pulsating, spectacular 500 watts when the wind is right and the ionosphere cooperates and closes in. Thus, even I was astonished when the Wall Street Journal accused our station of being the quintessential community station in America, and even Andy Schwartzman has nice things to say about us. As the commission weighs all the pleadings cascading into its deliberative process on the issue of consolidation, it might be useful, I think, to consider just what a radio station is. I think it can resemble more than a jukebox. I believe a station achieves its highest calling when it resembles a platform, a forum, a soapbox, a podium for the expression of many different viewpoints. Each station has the potential to be merely more than a conduit, Mr. Poltrack and others, for the delivery of information and hype about products and services, many of which we don't need and some can ill afford. Radio stations, if they're done right, I think, can be about more than commerce or rating points. And if we do it right, I don't want to shock anybody by quoting a Democrat, but Mario Cuomo says that a radio station can make a community stronger and better and even sweeter than it is. Now, having said that, there is no question that locally owned and locally operated hometown community radio stations operated in the public interest by broadcasters who speak the language of the neighborhoods are fast disappearing. No matter how much Eddie Fritz and NAB spend on surveys designed to celebrate so-called diversity on the airwaves, local, regional, community stations are succumbing everywhere to the siren song of the big group operators. They're selling out, and independent voices, you don't need a musician to tell you this, are being replaced by a cookie-cutter cacophony of the same old music, and often accompanied by vulgar, outrageous, and tasteless stunts. The old-time working local broadcaster is being replaced by asset managers, beholden to corporate masters a whole continent away. Clusters presided over by market managers, absentee owners, and speculators trying to cover their assets now control most major markets where many different voices were once heard in the land. Most stations today are run out of airport lounges by paid gun itinerant journeymen market specialists trying to squeeze every last dime out of their properties. Economies of scale, they have their wonderful business speak phrases, win-win situations, getting it done. Don't sit next to a broadcaster on an airplane. He'll drive you nuts. Doing what it takes. Make it happen. They've all replaced those quaint old phrases like public trustee who operated in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. Now comes the however, very briefly. Maybe, consolidation is a temporary circumstance, a temporary fact of life driven by free market forces. And maybe when they realize they can't run 1,000 stations out of San Antonio, they'll begin to dismantle these behemoths themselves and sell off some of those properties to independent entrepreneurs who will once more consider they have a fiduciary relationship to an instrument of communication and who will then steer them back to the service of the people in their community. And some of them might even consider that they're in a profession, not an industry. The Southerners on the NAB call it an industry, and thus at the people's business. Now, I had this line. See, Marty Franks, I was going to leave this line out, but what the hell? We might even see broadcasters who would be appalled at the notion of putting a price on public service we provide during national emergencies or catastrophes, and by those who would tarnish our finest hours by seeking compensation for the interruption of their business. And one network is trying to recapture $200 million for their finest hour, what they did on 9/11. So I guess I am, at the end of the day, Senator Javits, great New Yorker, father of the War Powers Act. Where are you when we really need you? Senator Javits once said, you either believe in the genius of the free enterprise system, .. or you do not. I think I am, at the end of the day, a believer in that free market stuff.